Welcome to the Fat Tonys Podcast, where we bridge the gap between everyday life and expert insight. Join us in conversation with real-world experts, gaining practical advice and strategies to navigate the complexities of the modern world.
Welcome, everyone, back to another special edition of the Fat Tonys podcast. This is part two of a two-part talk discussion with Joan Shields, a retired nurse who is also an advocate for homegrown and organic foods. If you want to hear more about Joan's background in nursing and with organic foods and full introduction, please go back and listen to that previous episode. It's really, really excellent. I had such a fun time talking to Joan about those topics. The reason we're doing a second topic is because after we finished, we were talking a little bit about how we both really wanted to talk about COVID. And Joan actually messaged me and said, oh, I'd really love to come back and do a second interview specifically discussing COVID because I'm just so sad that we ran out of time last time, and I was as well, and we decided we were going to do this. So I'm not going to ask Joan to introduce herself again, but what I am going to do, Joan, is just ask you why you felt so passionately about wanting to come back and talk about COVID specifically and your context of this.
Well, thank you. Thank you for agreeing. Two reasons I want to discuss this. Number one, there will be another novel disease, a virus showing up, and it lead to a pandemic. And that's absolutely. The more they keep cutting down trees, deforestation, having animals come closer to us, the more they do research with gain of function viruses to see how we could make vaccines, which is all important, but we don't have the safety protocol in place that are being followed, and there's very little accountability. And the reason I'm passionate about this, I happen to have the good fortune of starting my nursing career before the diagnosis of AIDS even came up, where I had a patient, now long dead, who had some strange disease that they didn't know what to even diagnose. It was called atypical T-cell leukemia, and that meant they couldn't measure their T-cells. So we wore full hazmat PPE gear, covered, no skin exposed, face respiratory precautions all in place to protect that patient. But it was also to protect us because we didn't know how that patient contracted this strange disease. Their partner was from another country and had died, and there was very little patient history. So it was a great learning experience. We protected ourselves and we protected the patient from our possible contagions, because they had no immune system to speak of. And they died, unfortunately, but it was a great learning experience. And that's basically the precautionary principle. When you don't know, and there's a small risk to injure somebody very large, or a population, or even environment, if there's a small risk to do a very bad harm, big harm, you want to initiate the precautionary principle. And that was so early in my nursing career. I think that was 1980. Fast forward to now I'm a registered nurse working in New York City in Queens at a hospital that was designated to be an AIDS center. So anyone in this area of Queens that needed hospitalization was admitted to this hospital. And we all had to work this unit because nobody wanted to work this unit. And the reason was, and this is why COVID will come into play, we didn't have PPE protocol. We didn't even have a White House that was mentioning the word AIDS. HIV hadn't been found. The virus, the human immunodeficiency virus, hadn't been discovered yet. But people had acquired an immune deficiency somehow. And what the narrative was that it was a gay men, people that frequented gay establishments, Haiti. Haiti had a gay population that were forbidden for entry into the U.S., and a government that wasn't mentioning it. Now, why, as a public health perspective, this was tremendous, was because everyone knows around 1980, it wasn't easy to be a gay person. Many had two lives. They were perhaps bisexual. It wasn't discussed. So wives, females, were contracting AIDS and they didn't know how. I know of one of my patients who was a widowed woman. We had to take a detailed history and physical of their medical history, who swore she had no intimate relations. She had no IV drug abuse. We were discovering that AIDS was being spread through contaminated needles because one person using a needle from another of heroin was common. She had none of this background, but she did have a cardiac surgery where she required blood transfusion. And we're telling them, it's in the blood. We know it's in the blood. I'm working a trauma unit, hanging units of blood, administering units of blood to patients, and petrified at the blood supply. I had not one but two colleagues. One was a friend, contracted AIDS from a needle stick, and another who was an anesthesiologist also contracted AIDS and died. And we still didn't have PPE protocol. I myself was getting written up and reprimanded for wearing too much PPE. Where are my guidelines? Is this a respiratory transmission? If somebody is coughing, can I catch AIDS? If it's all we were getting was from the Daily News, a newspaper in New York City that was updating us because we weren't getting guidelines. And they said it's in body fluids. And the 1199 Nurses AIDS Association had every right, until you give us any kind of protocols, we don't want to care for patients who have high fevers, are sweating. Is it in their sweat? I remember once I was emptying a urinal, measured, you know, urinal for a man, measured and went to flush it, and I little splattered on my wrist, and I was nervous. I did not know how it was spread. So those kinds of things. Joan, you're wearing too many masks. We were piloting new N95s. They weren't a thing yet. The N95 mask, the one, it got the name 95 because 95% of the particles through aerosols and droplets will be blocked. Fabulous. And we tried a few of them and they kept saying, stop wearing so many. Too bad. I would tell them, I didn't put in for overtime. You want to pay my overtime or you're going to pay for these extra PPE I'm using until you can give us a set of protocols. And this is where I get on Dr. Fauci's case. He became the director of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Disease in 1984. And we did not get PPE protocol until 87. It took the actor Rock Hudson to die before we had a White House, Reagan, say the name AIDS, because Ronald Reagan had been an actor. Those kinds of situations haunt me. I had one woman, just not to belabor AIDS, but one woman in particular stays with me. She had a baby and needed a blood transfusion. She was a healthy woman. She got a blood transfusion after her baby, not knowing it was contaminated with AIDS. She went on to have a second child. That second child contracted AIDS because she had it and while she carried him. Her nightmare, her hell on earth, was by the time she was my patient, she was end stage, knowing not that her child, not that she was going to die, she was dying soon, but that her child would go through the same thing without her there to take care of them. So you will hear Dr. Fauci admit that there were mistakes, that we should take this seriously, that we knew that it was not just gay men. And even if it was just gay men, don't their lives matter? And especially in public health, but he didn't like that he had death threats, which he should never have had. But when someone you love dies and nobody gives a shit about them, it can bring out an anger that goes too far. And it did, but he plays that up instead of, let's learn from these mistakes. And we didn't. We had, oh gosh, we've had a few, believe it or not, we've had a few that people just weren't as affected as time went on. H1N1. In 99, the White House was the Bush administration, came up with pandemic protocols. It was even a 3-hour course. and all follows the precautionary principle. When a novel disease virus shows up, you don't know what it is. This could be the virus that kills most of mankind, humankind. We don't know. So take all precautions, ASAP, and then hope and pray that this isn't as bad as it needs to be, and we can remove the precautions. We did it ass backwards. Fast forward to Ebola. Again, this is my experience. I was in Bellevue, and Bellevue in New York City, in Manhattan, New York City, did have an Ebola patient, and I noticed we had the wrong PPE protocol for Ebola. So did CDC, so did the World Health Organization. And I talked to a few people, and a few of us who had taken the course knew this was wrong. They didn't have complete protection, how skin was could be exposed. I did not care for the Ebola patient that was there, but I know the PPE protocol was wrong, and we saw it. We've only had 11 patients in the U.S. that ever had Ebola, and the one that made national, international news was, and I can, I'm not violating HIPAA privacy protocols for health, Mr. Duncan. His, everything about Mr. Duncan, who had come from Africa, from a region that had Ebola, went to an ER. They sent him home. They did. I cannot blame the ER personnel because they were not educated. Communication on this disease was not there. So I want to defend them, even though they should have researched a little better on somebody coming from that region. So he put him, they've sent him home, exposing him to family and friends. He came back, and eventually when he was admitted, two nurses contracted Ebola from this one patient. And unfortunately, there is an NDA, so they sued. And there's Dr. Fauci and Dr. Friedman, who was in charge of the CDC, with their arm around one of the nurses as if, look how much we care about them. I tweeted to them. I called the CDC on a Friday. You have the wrong PPE protocol. And they admitted those mistakes. And since then, we had a Department of Homeland Security who had put out all kinds of pandemic preparedness plans. And those protocols all are followed by the precautionary principle. And you have levels of following safety measures to protect us all. You want to protect your health workers. They're not going to be able to protect anybody admitted. You want to protect the public. And these protocols were updated every 2 years. Even the World Health Organization followed. The Department of Homeland Security was actually in charge of pandemic. And that Homeland Security was only, a department was only established after 9/11, which another failure. They didn't protect our frontline workers there. They said the air quality was safe when it wasn't. And so many have died. More firefighters have died, something close to my heart because of my husband who worked that day. It was 8 hours. I didn't know where he was because phone communications, and I thought he was in the rubble. But he worked every single day after that, exposed to all those toxins. And I would see so many pictures. This was before cell phones all had cameras. That wasn't as common. And I would see pictures. I said, why aren't you wearing a mask? It's, oh, it's fine. You know, Mr. Cool thought it was fine. And yes, he's had four different cancers since then. He's a survivor. But PPE would have protected. Even if the air quality was safe, which it wasn't. And there's a whole controversy on that because scientists came up and said the EPA lied about the air quality. But that should have been a big lesson. It's so cheap in the long run. It's so cost effective to protect than it is to clean up the mess later on. So if you take all those experiences that I've had, and I've always overwear PPE just to protect myself. And now you come to COVID. When did you first hear about this weird disease that was in China? Do you remember?
Well, before I answer that, I just want to pick up on a couple of things you mentioned there.
Sure.
The firstly, it's absolutely fascinating to hear personal recollections of the early HIV in New York in the 80s. And it's really interesting to me. I was born in the mid-80s, so by the time I was old enough to be aware, we'd already have that retrospective learning. So I was grew up with this very solid knowledge of this is what HIV is, this is how it spreads, this is how it works. Now, I remember a number of years ago watching a documentary, BBC British series called Horizon, which is kind of pop science documentary that tackles a different issue every week. It's been going for, I think 40 years. And there is an episode.
I've got to look it up. Go ahead.
Please do. There is an episode on YouTube from, I think it's 1982, 1983. And the episode title is called Killer in the Village. And it's about this strange new virus happening in the gay village in New York and what's happening. And what's absolutely fascinating watching this retrospectively now, that even as an impartial scientific documentary, just how much they got wrong. And it wasn't for sensationalism. It wasn't political. It's just this lesson as when you are living through events as they are unfolding, it is totally different to retrospectively looking back at them a few years later. And I feel exactly the same way with COVID, something I have lived through, unfortunately. But I think that just underscores the absolute cruciality of the precautionary principle. This idea that if there is a systemic risk, and we're not just talking about, you know, while individual deaths are absolutely horrific, but if there is a systemic risk to the population, then any kind of traditional risk-reward analysis needs to be thrown out the window. And there needs to be, you know, a much stricter, might be the wrong word, but a much more aggressive attitude towards it. And what's really interesting for me, you sent me a timeline over, and this has kind of helped jog my memory of events as they were unfolding during COVID. But for me, the first time I really became aware of it was Nassim's tweet. So Nassim Taleb, author of the Inserto series of books, I'm sure everyone listening to this podcast knows that. But he was so early on this. And I know you know as well, Joan, because we both saw his tweets. We both saw the paper that he co-authored. Really, I think only a few weeks after, two or three weeks after the very, very early reports started making it to mainstream media of things going on in China. And Nassim calling for the employment of the precautionary principle to take aggressive moves to avoid catastrophe. Now, what's interesting is on your timeline, you mentioned January 14th, 2020, you noticed videos of Chinese cities circulating, healthcare workers in full protective clothing. You said they were being shared on Instagram, but they were being taken down straight away. Why do you think that was?
Initially, I thought it was because it was a hoax. I'm saying approximately January 24th. I did not take screenshots or videos of any of it. My daughter, a travel blogger at the time, traveling all over, I sent it to her. I said, are you hearing about this? I think she was in Bahamas then. I don't call, but she said, no. I said, they're taking these down. What is this? And then scouring the internet, because it wasn't just videos. It was videos of healthcare workers showing a small, maybe a 10 by 10 room, a small 10 foot by 10 foot room of shrouded bodies, of ICUs that I've never seen, such large ICUs. I found out later on they created large rooms, and everybody in the full hazmat PPE gear. And I started to get worried and looking around, and now I saw the World Health Organization was keeping an eye on this. Nassim's precautionary principle paper was published January 26th. It was actually the same day I had tweeted, this could be the big one. Follow general precautionary principle. Use good stewardship. We've trained for this. And I was a bit optimistic. We'll catch it. We know it's here in the world. At that time, it was China, and I think Italy was gaining more. But we had our first was January 20th. Now, understand, this was also close to Chinese New Year, which was January 25th that year, end of January. But wow, you have people from around the world going back to China because it's Chinese New Year and coming back to our populations. I have large Chinese communities in every world, in every country, excuse me. So it's something to be protective of. We have politicians going to Chinatown, hugging Chinese people to prove that we are not against Chinese. Of course, we're not against Chinese people. We're against spreading this virus. And the Chinese who did come back quarantined themselves in spite of the lack of policies and protocols that were given from New York City. I'm talking New York City because JFK is such a big hub, and this is where I paid close attention. So on January 24th, before there was even a Trump coronavirus task force, he did put together a large task force. And if people could pay attention to health laws that govern our political bodies, they would know as much as a medical illiterate Donald Trump was, he did everything he was supposed to. What he didn't do is keep his mouth shut about crazy things. But at the end of saying, for instance, this could be a hoax, I don't know, he'd always add that almost a protective measure from legal responsibility. What do I know? That's what he'd say. But he's right, because he did put together a coronavirus task force. And Dr. Fauci met some senators to give a briefing about it, and we found out that they sold off their stock. So I'd love to know what was said in that meeting, January 24th. So these are just, I put together the timeline so we could see exactly where it went wrong. So here's Mark Zuckerberg, who, by the way, we found out later on was talking with Dr. Fauci, who was not actually the head of the coronavirus task force. It was Mike Pence, our vice president, and Dr. Deborah Birx. These two should have been more focused, but it was Dr. Fauci making all the cable news rounds. He always spoke at our White House press briefing on the coronavirus every single day. So the task force was put together on January 29th. On January 30th, Global Nurses United, I'm a member of National Nurses United in the United States, but Global Nurses United sent a letter urging the World Health Organization to follow aerosol precautions, just like Chinese healthcare workers were. And then we saw Italy, and we saw them all in their full PPE. And on January 30th, when they sent this letter, they wanted Dr. Tedros, who is the director of the World Health Organization, to please follow aerosol precautions, protect our healthcare workers. If we don't protect the healthcare workers, who's going to protect the patients? And to follow the precautionary principle. And they didn't. On January 31st, we had a global health emergency is now established by the World Health Organization and by the United States. We are in a health emergency, and we did not initiate our health emergency alert system. We have it. I don't know if you have it, but for us, it's called the FCC Emergency Alert System, and it sounds an alarm on your TV, on your cell phone, and tells you, in the event of an emergency, where you should go and what you should do. It could be for whatever, catastrophic event, God forbid, a terrorist attack. But in this case, it was a health emergency, and we did not get it. And believe it or not, as much as I do point all my fingers at the coronavirus task force for not following the policy and not following the World Health Organization, it's ultimately up to your local health. In the United States, we have a federal Department of Health and Human Services. And then we have a state Department of Health and Human Services. And then we have a county. I'm in Nassau County in New York State. And we have a Department of Health. And there I am calling Lauren Curran, our Nassau County executive at the time, asking her, what the hell do you have the Nassau Coliseum open for? There's going to be a dino expo with, you know, dinosaurs at this huge coliseum of where they have sporting events and music concerts and what have you. Hofstra University, many people know, is attached pretty much on the same plot of land. They were closed. So there were different policies going on because everyone was waiting for guidance from the higher up instead of realizing you're in charge of where you are locally. That should be the message. lack of communication. We had $6 billion, right? These things should have been done.
When you talk about the precautionary principle, I think a lot of, I hate to say this, but I think in the early days that we're talking about now, there was conversation around the economic implications of things like very severe lockdowns. And the point they were missing, even if you look at this purely from an economic point of view, which is very cold-hearted, but even if you look at it from there, for every pound you lose or every dollar you lose by going into a lockdown, you're going to save, you know, $20, $50, $100 in terms of the economic meltdown will happen if you don't have this short-term shock. And certainly that happened in the UK. It's interesting. Can I ask, Joan, did the USA then, you talk about this federal sort of slightly fragmented response in the US, was there ever a national lockdown or a federally mandated lockdown?
No. And what's worse is not only did they not follow their own protocols, their own policies, the studies, the conferences I would watch on large screens of Dr. Fauci telling us to prepare. They dropped it all, and I don't know why. When I continue on the timeline, and this one really gets to me, there was a press conference. They do discuss economics in all the pandemic preparedness plan. We have to consider that. What you hope to do with the word quarantine, meaning quarantine is 40, and I think it initiated in Croatia. I think that's where we first had sailors coming in that may have had something. The kings and leaders stay out on your ship for 40 days, quarantine. We had people, and I know this personally from my daughter and a girlfriend, that were coming in February, flying into JFK that weren't under any travel restrictions or screenings. We saw that immediately, the World Health Organization and the U.S. on the same day, January 31st, initiated travel screenings. And they said, well, we won't let people come from China. They did. We will monitor symptoms. Well, how do you know it's not an incubation period and asymptomatic? There was actually one woman that they think was 42 days of an incubation period before she developed symptoms. What are you doing? And people who knew they had something hid their symptoms, loaded up with Tylenol to hide their fever, didn't cough. They weren't listening to lungs, you know, to see if there was any congestion. And then they came home, they did not self-quarantine, and they flew to other places, spreading it because they had it. It was, the failures were beyond. But every single day, the World Health Organization did give a daily briefing. And they kept saying, we can contain this if we follow these procedures. But we didn't.
It's astounding. It's astounding, isn't it? You see this kind of definition of this intellectual yet idiot, or shall we say, people who are so separated from the consequences of their actions that they do not just have this skin in the game mechanism to make rational decisions. And I suppose our equivalent in the UK would be Matt Hancock, who was the Minister, Secretary of State for Health during the COVID crisis. And I remember one of the very, very earliest decisions he made was to all of the old elderly people who were in hospital with COVID, was to discharge them and send them all back to their care homes across the country, which is just madness from my point of view. You're sending people with a highly infectious, deadly, unknown disease. We have so many unknowns into a population center of the weakest people in society.
Most vulnerable.
You're most vulnerable, sorry.
No, we understand weak immunity. You know, that's okay. It was also if you can understand the class system that we pretend we don't have, but we do. The nurses' aides that were caring for those that were coming back into the nursing home. They too were contracting it. And a nurse's aide isn't a PhD in science. They don't hold all that weight according to the way they're treated. And I've said it before, nurse's aides are the backbone of everything. They're the ones working the most physically with our loved ones in the hospital. They're the ones that alert the nurses and the doctors of a problem. And when we saw if you can understand, in these pandemic plans now that do include the cautionary principle, they also have a level of risk. And if the risk gets to past normal risk, they'll call it, it's automatic respiratory, I'm talking a respiratory infection that's spread, transmitted through respiration, aerosol, droplet, what have you. And once you hit high, it's full precautions. School closures can even happen. Containment, containment, containment. The World Health Organization lifted it up to the very high, the highest that they had for the globe. There is a global risk that everybody is exposed to this. We must contain it. And there was Dr. Fauci the very next day. The risk to the Americans is very low. Don't do anything yet. And our first New York City nurses died 2 weeks later. You know why? On February 7th, going back to that timeline, our Department of Health and Human Services under Trump donated 18 tons of our stockpiled PPE. Do you know what the very first task that a nurse manager has when they are under health emergency for respiratory transmission? You stock up on PPE. They gave it away. Our nurses in New York City were taking N95 masks, wearing them all day long, hanging them on little clotheslines with their names on the outside, spraying both sides. They were wearing plastic bags, their own, buying Hefty. I don't know the brand you have by you, but tall trash garbage bags, plastic, and making their own gowns. While we saw the Chinese and Italy all in full PPE, we made our nurses. I went, believe it or not, to tattoo parlor and nail salon parlor owners' homes who were donated. They all wear masks. Tattoo guy, you know, they're always with the fumes, and nail salons, they wear the N95s. There were some dentists that closed their offices and they donated the big masks, you know, the real fitted ones, mm-hmm. more than a 95, the ones that can be reused and are plastic. And I don't remember the brand, but because my local hospital, my nephew working in the FDNY did not have masks. And I got some, and I asked, this was April, that I had to get some masks. And when I got them, he did have some. So they say the greatest healthcare system in the world. we have all the knowledge. We just don't have the tools. And nobody had been educated enough. So the nurses, the healthcare workers were following what their administration was doing. And their administration was really following what the White House was saying. And they did not, if you knew that, we found out later on that our White House health leaders, Dr. Fauci, knew about this in December and did not initiate mask mandates until April. I sit here and wonder. Social distancing, I don't think you need a PhD in virology to know this is a virus I know nothing about. How far do I have to be apart? And Dr. Fauci was just interviewed by a congressional committee saying they made it up. There was no science behind social distancing. I said, yes, there is. It's in the pandemic plans. I can't help but think there was something shady going on. And my best guess, this is a guess. They realized it did come from a lab and they try to downplay it, not realizing, holy shit, this thing is spreading. That's my two cents. I could be 100% wrong. I'm open for that. But either way, they handled it so poorly. And we watched my sister-in-law died, my aunt died, only because we're in New York City. My aunt died alone in a nursing home where my cousin's wife was a nurse who cared for her but couldn't be there because she was sick. And my uncle was broken that she died alone. She didn't. I promise you, people take care of the people that were sick. But we have a lot of nurses' aides that were coming forward with videos saying, I have 61 patients on my unit and they are all COVID positive, and I have two nurses to care for them. And what did we see? We saw a lot of burnout and people left the job. They saw their coworkers die, people left the job. And everything we feared before COVID was a healthcare shortage, not because there aren't a ton of healthcare workers, but because hospitals chose to go cheap and not hire enough staff all these years. And now you put this deadly virus that's spreading in hospitals and healthcare facilities.
It's interesting, Joan. I know on our previous episode, we talked about the ironic fact that the UK and the US healthcare systems are so ideologically different, but have a lot of the same problems. And PPE procurement was a huge issue over here, not just in the lack of PPE in certain areas, but the uneven spread of it. I think there were scandals about, you know, places where there were warehouses of unused PPE, which weren't being redistributed to the right places. And it was a huge scandal. And, you know, this idea of over-optimizing a system to save money and then not being prepared for when something like this comes along, it reminds me a little bit of the financial crisis as well. You know, after the 2008 crisis, we had all of these lawmakers saying, oh, nothing like this will happen again. We're going to introduce all of these rules, these regulations, these laws. And already you can see that as soon as enough time has passed, any lessons learnt or purported to have been learnt will be forgotten, and the same behavior will creep back in, and you will see history repeat itself. And I don't know what the answer to that is, why there isn't societal memory. I think they may be amongst populations, but maybe are not amongst policy makers or bureaucracy. Maybe they're just not capable of that. It's also interesting, you know, we talked about there was no federally mandated lockdown in the US. I didn't quite realize that, to be honest. And it's interesting because the USA, not only is it structural level decentralized a federation, but ideologically, it is a very, very individualist society. So, you know, the response, I imagine if there had been a mandated federal lockdown, would not have been good from certain areas of a population, just like it wasn't in the UK. You know, it really split the country apart. And to be honest, the effectiveness of a lockdown too late, that could be talked about as well, because we went through one of the strictest lockdowns in the world. I think, you know, then you look at countries like Australia and New Zealand, who, and Japan, in my opinion, did the correct thing, which was they exercised the precautionary principle early. They locked down the population, but more importantly, and I'd say more effectively than that, they created a bubble around their country. They stopped air traffic coming in early enough to stop it being an issue. And for me, that's really the key, because, you know, we're talking about our timeline, January, February. I think our first lockdown in the UK was late March. And even then, we had several lockdowns with slightly different rules, but, you know, even then it was, you know, I think this was the one where you could meet up to four people, or you could do this, you could do that. And, you know, lots of places were still open. And more importantly, I think air traffic was still coming in up to that point, which is crazy. If you look at an overconnected system, it doesn't take a genius. The first thing is air traffic. Stop the air traffic. That would have been, you know, I think anyone could have reasonably looked at this in the early days and said, cut the air traffic off, or, you know, introduce some severe quarantine for air traffic.
We needed that. We didn't. I literally got out of bed at 2 o'clock in the morning, one very rainy day night, because I kept hearing all these airplanes. 2 o'clock is usually dies down. I'm not far from JFK. But when it rains, a lot of flights are delayed and they still will arrive late. And I thought we had just had 1,500 people die of COVID in New York City. And here are these flights coming in, piling in. It didn't matter where. I was documenting as if I was going to travel from China to the US to JFK. I could get a flight anytime I wanted because they didn't restrict it. And they weren't. It's another thing, if you're going to allow air traffic, then you need really good protocols, mandates with really strict consequences of not being followed for travel. And they weren't. A girlfriend traveling in from LAX, zero. Nobody asked her if she was sick, where she was going. Did she have her temperature taken? Any symptoms? COVID testing? Nothing. Now fast forward to my daughter thinking for sure. This was March 13th. She was certain she had this strange COVID because she said, Mom, I could feel my lungs. She lived 2 miles down the road from me. I breathe. I could feel where they are. I don't feel good. Medical doctor doesn't have the test, said you have to get it from the Department of Health. Call the Department of Health 3 hours. They said you can go to Jones Beach very large parking area. Jones Beach is a big portion of South Shore of Long Island, and they have a lot of parking. We're having testing there. Jones Beach said you got an approval, a prescription from your doctor. I'm losing my mind. Doctor, Department of Health, Jones Beach, we could not get a test. So she had what I think was COVID. Couldn't get antibody testing afterwards. We treated her as if she was. I went to her side door and left things on her patio because I was not going near her. Those kinds of things. We said, boy, is this awful. They can't even coordinate what they're doing. Doctors didn't know. Department of Health and the testing centers were all wrong. And we watched just more and more people die. And then they were complaining, well, Florida doesn't have mandates, but they don't have as many people. I said, well, we have mandates. They put a lockdown, and then all of a sudden, at the end of March, in comes the USS Comfort, a big hospital ship. And everybody in New York City was out on the street filming the Comfort ship. I said, what happened to the lockdown? One man wasn't wearing a mask in Brooklyn and went to a bodega, and he got the shit kicked out of him from law enforcement because he wasn't masked, and he argued. Meanwhile, the same day, we watched a whole park of people just hanging out. They weren't on lockdown. So not only did they initiate policies too late and mandates, they did not enforce them properly. And today, as we knew, we've been seeing COVID numbers grow. They didn't put mandates in until it was too late. We now have mandates in many hospitals in New York, fire department, many first responders. Not every hospital, it's not mandated, but around here, my son's girlfriend happens to be a nurse, and she's a lot of admissions, not just COVID, but flu. And they put mask mandates back in place, and people are up in arms. And now the big mask wars. I took care of my mother. If you don't care about getting COVID, do you care about giving it to someone else? And my mom, who already had dementia, contracted COVID, unfortunately, from someone who didn't have symptoms yet. They work in a school, and they brought it to her. Of course, I was livid because I told everybody wear masks, but I wasn't there that day. And I took care of her for 18 days in a row. And I masked, every ounce of what she needs from bathroom, brushing teeth, coughing, wiping her nose, changing her. I didn't get it because I know how to put a mask on by washing my hands first and how to take it. I took it off on her front porch. I wore a gown. I wore everything. And I just took everything off on the front porch, washed my hands on the front porch before I left. So there are ways to prevent. And I've never contracted anything from a hospital. I worked with a lot of TB patients. They all, unfortunately, were admitted to the AIDS unit because sharing needles was also sharing TB, which was very common, unfortunately. I masked, and everybody, we have a test that could tell if you've been exposed to TB, and none of mine did. So those are the failures. Do you want to know some ideas I have to prevent it next time? It's really easy. It's education. We had a mandate before you could renew your license if you're a health personnel and teacher on identifying and reporting abuse, especially for children. Infectious disease control. They should have a pandemic preparedness mandated course, and it should be every 2 years, the way we have to be updated on CPR certification and first aid. They want us updated every 2 years. And I'm not fully retired. I do side work. A lot of reading court transcripts and a lot of patient advocacy. So maybe I'm not getting paid, but I still act like a nurse and I do a lot of home care and private duty for friends, family, and what have you. So I stay up close and in charge. And I know when I want to renew a license, I should be mandated that I cannot renew it until I take this course. That's number one. Number two, we have a text alert system. I just got a text alert that we were having really heavy winds last week. We should have a text alert system in place, and it should be voluntary. And a lot of volunteer healthcare workers, first responders, educators would love to be a part of this. I know it. I speak with them. Imagine going to a PTA, the Parent Teachers Association, go to schools and talk about it. so it's not completely foreign to them. All these words, social distancing, remote learning, was all part of the plan since 2006. We had it there, just nobody learned it. And I was foolish enough to think people had, because I did. I taught it. We hosted pandemic drills and disaster drills, which are really the same thing. You order PPE, you make sure nobody goes on vacation or holiday, you get as many patients out of the hospital as you can, set up with home care and make it available. And you know the protocols, you know the PPE protocols. We have some nurses that don't like masks. Oh boy. But I could see that when you watch that battle. If you look up masks on Twitter, look at the fight on both sides. People swear they don't work. People swear they do. Science goes back and forth. Prevention is not taught. And this is a communication problem from the beginning. And this is no longer considered a mistake when you do it this often in healthcare. It's negligence. And I would say there's a very good case for criminal medical negligence against the coronavirus task force. Even for when Biden became president, just before he was elected, because he was elected November 2020, when the vaccine was really on the verge of being approved for emergency use, he and a lot of other Democrat politicians made a video. They were not going to get this vaccine because if Trump is elected, as if he had anything to do with making a vaccine. You know, it's the same vaccine manual. What do you care? Trump's an idiot. Anyone who followed Trump, the junk food king, for medical advice, not to say you deserve it, but that's very foolish. He was not a medical person. So if you follow Fauci, you would have been screwed too. Became so political. Anybody who, if you criticize Fauci, that must mean you're a Trump supporter. It's crazy. No, I'm a health supporter, and they're all doing it wrong. So these are little tips that if you keep it localized, education, volunteer, text message, everybody take this course. We could do this. Ventilation. Do you know how simple ventilation could be to install? We should have had this years ago, having nothing to do with COVID. We've known this, and they didn't. My husband had his knee replaced in December of 2021. And I was allowed in the hospital with him. As I'm in the holding area, I'm noticing a filter. And I talked to the charge nurse, and she said, we got COVID relief money, and I purchased air filters for every single bedside because they weren't putting it overhead. She goes, and I cracked. Do you know they don't crack windows in hospitals? One patient one time who was off their medications threw a big chair through a window, jumped out, and died. And the hospital he's working at, that's it. Every hospital window has to be closed. We need ventilation. So those little, very little things in the long run could save so much. And that's where my frustration lies. Any questions? Did I say it enough?
It would be good. It would be nice to think that the policymakers at high levels will face some kind of a reckoning or
accountability
for their decisions. I'm slightly pessimistic that will happen. You know, just based off what I've seen in my lifetime, thinking about maybe actions in Iraq and Afghanistan after September 11th, I'm thinking, you know, other pandemics that have happened. It's interesting. I remember being in Hong Kong in 2003 when the SARS pandemic was occurring. And I remember flying back in the midst of that, and they had in the airport this system, infrared system, and they had a huge TV projected on the wall, and anyone who was slightly above normal body temperature was glowing up like a Christmas tree, you know, on this huge screen, and they would immediately be pulled out of the line and not allowed to get on the plane. And I, you know, that was back in 2003, and I don't think I saw anything like that anywhere with COVID this time around. I mean, maybe it was in certain places, and I'm not saying it would be 100% effective. Of course it wouldn't, but, you know, non-invasive ways like that where, you know, if you're saying to someone, you have to take a test, and there's this knee-jerk reaction from certain members of society, like, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. But something as non-invasive as, you know, an infrared camera to pick up fevers, you know, could have gone a long way. I'm really sorry. We're coming up. This always goes super quick, but we're coming up to the end of our hour. Is there any last, I always call it Jerry's final thoughts from the Jerry Springer Show, but is there any last comments or anything you wanted to say?
Well, I say follow your Global Nurses United, because their job is to protect nurses, and in protecting nurses, they protect us. So that's an easy thing to do, especially when we have something new brewing. They're on top of it. Practice prevention that involves something that's not a vaccine. I won't even get into the vaccine. That's a debate of horrors. But vaccines do help prevent the spread of diseases. And just think, it's common sense when you think about it. Social distancing, just common sense to protect. And in the long run, it saves a lot of money. If you're more interested in money, you're going to save money if you practice prevention. So that's my two cents.
Thank you. I'm going to finish with reading the closing paragraph of the 2020 paper, the precautionary principle paper. It came out, you know, in January, and I just think it's so prescient when you read it back now. It will cost something to reduce mobility in the short term. To fail to do so will eventually cost everything. If not from this event, then one in the future. Outbreaks are inevitable, but an appropriately precautionary response can mitigate systemic risk to the globe at large. But policy and decision makers must act swiftly and avoid the fallacy to have an appropriate respect for uncertainty in the face of possible, irreversible catastrophe. This amounts to paranoia or the converse belief that nothing can be done. Reading that back now just seems so prescient.
I'm filled with tears listening to it.
It's a shame people, you know, policymakers didn't listen. You know, it's a shame that it happened, but it has happened. And we can only hope that in future, they listen more. So, Joan, thank you so much for coming on and sharing this with us. I've really, really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Same here. Talk soon.